The Tom Woods Show, episode 663.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Is email driving you crazy and taking over your life? Do you feel like you can never possibly get and stay caught up? Well, here's my secret weapon. Sanebox.com/woods. That's SaneBox.com/woods. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. Sheldon Richman joins the program once again today. He's got a brand new book out. It's an easy read. It's a quick read, but it's a provocative and challenging read. It's about the Constitution, and Sheldon is a bit of a skeptic, so I'll give you more detail in just a minute when I bring Sheldon on. Sheldon is a long-time Liberty Movement guy, widely published, been featured all over the place, has numerous titles to his credit in terms of books. We've talked about his book on separating school and state in the past. But here, it's America's Counter-Revolution, his brand new book on the Constitution. We'll link to it on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/663. And I'm glad to welcome him back. Sheldon, thanks for being here.
Great to be with you, Tom. Thank you.
All right. I got a lot of requests, to have you on to talk about this book.
Oh, good.
So I just, you know, I thought, yeah, I'll get to it one of these days. But then it just kept coming. So I thought, all right, today's the day. We'll do it. All right. So the book is called America's Counter-Revolution, The Constitution Revisited. Now, that is a provocative title. I'm sure that's why you chose it. You chose that title. Let me ask you right away the question that you'd be most likely to get from constitutionalists who would say, you're throwing out the baby with the bathwater. If only we would interpret the Constitution the way it was originally intended. They'll agree with you. Yeah, everything's gone off the rails and a lot of terrible things are being done by the government. But if only we could just get back to the original meaning of the Constitution, everything would be all right. I would be inclined to think that you would be able to respond to that on all different levels.
That's right. The first thing I think I'd like to say to that is that it begs the question. It assumes there's, quote, an original meaning. Now, even within the originalist camp, there are differences of opinion. Some people will say it's the intention and meaning of the framers or of the ratifiers. Rainey Barnett and others, who claims to be a libertarian, talk about the original meaning to the sort of the society at large. You know, what did the text just mean to everyday people? It's not really clear what original meaning means. And we have to also keep in mind that the Constitution was a political document. It was the product of a compromise. And so there's a lot of vagueness. And legal language, constitutional language, is inherently underdeterminate. And by that, I don't mean that language doesn't mean anything. That would be ridiculous. Here we are having a conversation. But language, especially legal language and constitutional language, is going to be underdeterminate. In other words, there's going to be a lot of wiggle room. The framers knew that. Hamilton and Madison understood that they were not writing anything that was crystal clear. They knew, and they even concede some of this in the Federalist Papers, that the boundaries between the states and the national government and the boundaries between the three branches of government at the federal level those boundaries would be determined through political battles over the years. They were not under any illusion that they'd written this crystal clear document that everybody from now till eternity would understand and have no trouble observing. So I think it's a red herring, really, to say if we only got back to it. Besides, you know, as Lysander Spooner famously pointed out, at least famously among libertarians, you know, either the Constitution authorized the government that we have or it was powerless to prevent it. You know, the Constitution was never suspended in any formal way. Everybody always thought and argued that they were acting constitutionally, even when they were doing things that libertarians and so-called constitutionalists despise. So what happens? When you play the Constitution game, you got to be prepared to lose. I mean, all constitutions are living constitutions. I disagree that you can have something other than a living constitution, meaning people will always be interpreting it. There's no rope. We can't program a robot or a computer to give us flawless answers to every constitutional issue dispute that arises. It's always going to be people. And people have interests, and people have, even if they're honest, they're going to have differing interpretations, and there's no way to get away from that.
Sheldon, you mentioned Lysander Spooner, and of course he wrote about different aspects of the Constitution, but he also wrote about the overall idea of constitutions and this particular constitution. And his view was that the Constitution wasn't binding because it didn't have the consent of everybody involved. But that's not the line of argument you're taking in this book. It may be one you've taken in the past, but in this book, you're looking at the history of the Constitution. This is a history book here. And you're arguing, and you can see right in the title, that this is America's counter-revolution. So in what sense would the Constitution that is held out as a beacon of liberty to the whole world, how could that be thought of as a counter-revolution?
Well, you have to put it in its historical context, and unfortunately it seems to get dropped out. You would think, listening to lots of people, that the U.S. or the Americans won the revolution, drove the British out, and then immediately sat down and wrote the Constitution, and then things just went from there. There's sort of a lost 8 years before the war ended, this begins before the war ends, and 1787 or 1789 when the Constitution is ratified and goes into effect, namely the period of the Articles of Confederation. That gets really short shrift, even among libertarians, like, well, there were problems, and then we jumped to the Constitution.
Right.
I mean, you see this even with some hardcore libertarians. They may be minarchists, but they're very hardcore libertarians. And so I don't see this as an anarchist issue, by the way. You can be a limited government advocate and totally embrace my book. So it's not an art, even though the final chapter is about anarchism, called The Constitution of Anarchy. You don't have to be an anarchist to see what I'm saying here or to agree with it. During the Articles of Confederation, which I'm not claiming is a perfect libertarian era, by the way, but I am doing some comparison here, you had a quasi-central government. I call it a quasi-government because it lacked some very important, I think, defining powers that governments have, and one in particular, namely the power to tax. Now, people will remember this from their school days, if the articles even gets covered anymore in school, I don't know. But the central government had no power to tax, right? It was called the United States, was literally a confederation, a league of friendship of sovereign states. That's how it was seen. And if the central government needed money, it had to requisition it from the states. Now, as we know human nature, sometimes the check wasn't really in the mail when the national government asked for money from the states. It also had no power to regulate trade. These are two extremely important powers that it lacked, which is why I want to call it a quasi-government. Now, it did rely on taxation, but the taxing power was in the states. So it was a government, but not a full government. Lots of people back then thought that even among the anti-federalists, the people that didn't like the Constitution, thought that maybe the national government should have some limited power to tax. So there were discussions going on in that regard. But this is why it's a counter-revolution. The move toward a central government was a move away from decentralization. And I think that constitutes a counter-revolution, given what the American Revolution was, which was throwing an empire off the shores here. So that the states could manage themselves.
You know, it's funny, this whole Articles of Confederation thing, I was just looking on Facebook. The Articles of Confederation has 1,500 likes. There's a page for the Articles of Confederation, 1,500 likes. I mean, you and I probably know 1,500 people. You know, that's it. Whereas the U.S. Constitution, now there are several different Facebook, but there's the U.S. Constitution, U.S. Constitution, but if you put them all together, it's probably about 1 million. So, you could argue that the Articles of Confederation had its inconveniences if you want to make that argument. But to me, it's not so overwhelmingly obvious that the Constitution is to be preferred that the likes should be in that proportion. That is the result of nothing other than propaganda, right?
Well, I think so, because, look, I don't really remember my history lessons in junior high school and high school, or even freshman college. I don't remember. I assume we covered the Articles of Confederation. I'm just assuming it's an act of faith.
Right, but to dismiss it, right? Just to dismiss it.
Well, I'm sure if we covered it, it must have been covered. It's got to be covered.
Yeah.
These days, who knows? But back in my day, look, I was going to elementary school in the 50s, so I assume they were still covering it. But yeah, I'm sure it got very short shrift, and they said, oh, yes, everybody agreed there were problems. I'm sure we never heard the word anti-federalist. I'm pretty sure of that. And so, yes, there were problems. They realized there were something worse than inconveniences. And therefore, they met in Philadelphia, and these demigods, and this is a key to it, these demigods, not demagogues, by the way, demigods, in other words, half gods,
right?
These godly men totally wise and totally informed of what the public interest is, sat down in Philadelphia and wrote this wonderful document. That's the story I'm pretty sure we learned.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And basically, you're not even presented with the idea that there might have been a decent argument for not doing this. That would be unthinkable, of course, because this is our destiny. I mean, it's all caught up in this quasi-religious encasing. It's very odd.
Yes.
Let's talk about some specifics here. First of all, you've got because I think this is really you say the all-embracing power to tax. That's chapter 13, appropriately enough. Talk about that, because that key thing here, regardless of the general welfare clause, the commerce clause, you know, all this other stuff, that power to tax is so essential, not only because taxation, you know, is control, but also because you combine that with general welfare, and it means that even if something's not included in the Constitution, the government has the power to tax, and so it can therefore take that power and use it for Obamacare, use it for all kinds of things that aren't in there.
Yeah. Well, in fact, the Supreme Court has ruled, I forget what year this was, but it's not new, that the Congress can even accomplish through taxation what it explicitly is not allowed to accomplish through regulation.
That's what I was trying to say, right. Yeah.
And the Supreme Court said it doesn't matter whether raising revenue was secondary in the minds of the congressman who passed this bill. They can still do it. I mean, that's incredible. Well, this all-embracing power to tax is not even my phrase. It's from the Supreme Court, 1913 or 14, the case that that took up the Wilson income tax. In the case is known as Brewshaber. It even goes back to earlier to the Pollock case. See, in 1890, this is something that's not widely understood, even by libertarian law professors, because I've heard them speak about this and they get it wrong. In 1894, this is way past the era my book is about, but I do discuss it in the chapter you're referring to. Congress passes an income tax, and it goes to the Supreme Court. Now, people generally believe, libertarians generally believe, and I think most people generally believe that in 1895 the Supreme Court struck down that law because they said an income tax is unconstitutional. Then, as the story goes, in the progressive era, when Wilson comes in, well, actually it begins under Taft, a constitutional amendment gets rolling to permit an income tax. And the idea is that had to be done because the Supreme Court in the previous century had said income taxation is unconstitutional. That is wrong, at least in its essence. There's some minor details that are right about that. But here's what really happened. In 1895, the Supreme Court looked at that income tax that was passed the year before, and the challenge was not to the whole bill, but to the bill that laid an income tax on laid a tax on the income from property, real and personal property. In other words, let's say rents, other income from property, and interest from bonds and stocks and bonds. So, I believe a holder of stock in a bank challenged this and said, this is unconstitutional because to tax the income from property is equivalent to taxing the property itself. I'm not saying I buy this argument, but this is the argument that was made. So taxing the income from property is equivalent to taxing the property. Taxing property is a direct tax. The Constitution says you have to lay a direct tax on the basis of the census, in other words, a portion to the population of the states. This bill didn't do that, therefore that's invalid. The Supreme Court bought that argument, but then it went on to say we're going to knock down the whole law, including the tax on wages and salaries, because Congress's intent was not to put all the burden on wage earners. And if we strike out the property income part of it, all the burden will be on wage earners. That wasn't Congress's intent, therefore the whole bill falls. However, they said there was no question that Congress has the constitutional power to tax wages and salaries. So they passed the 16th Amendment, which the key phrase of which is from whatever source derived. If you read that amendment, it says Congress can tax income from whatever source derived. And what those few words meant was this, that the Supreme Court in the future, in judging the constitutionality of or anything about an income tax, can't look at the source of the income. That's from whatever source derived. And that addressed the 1895 Pollock case. So it was never, the income tax on wages and salaries was never ruled as unconstitutional. In fact, in those cases, the Supreme Court said that the, and it uses like six or seven synonyms for this, the power to tax under the Constitution is all-embracing, plenary, comprehensive. You think of every synonym you can to capture that idea, that's in those cases. And so the anti-federalists were vindicated because they were saying in the day, in 1787, what are you talking about? This is unlimited power to tax this document gives to Congress. And the Supreme Court later on said, yeah, that's true.
I got a juicy question for you, but first let's pause to thank our sponsor.
Folks, if you're like me, you're buried in email and you're pleading for help. You don't know what to do about it. It's interfering with your mental health and your life and your peace of mind, and you don't know what to do about it. Well, the answer is SaneBox. I use it myself. I swear by it. It sorts my email. It makes sure that I see the important stuff and that I can see the unimportant stuff on my own time when I get around to it. I can tell it to resend me emails in a couple of days when I'm ready to deal with them, so that by the end of the day, I have one way or another dealt with all my email every single day. You need this for your mental health. You need it for your productivity. You need it for efficiency. So check it out at SaneBox. That's SaneBox, SaneBox.com/Woods, and get a free trial. And then when you do what I did, which is when your free trial runs out, you immediately rush to throw money at them because you've got to have this service. You automatically get a $25 off credit as a Tom Woods Show listener. You've got to use that link, SaneBox.com/Woods.
All right, here's a question that my friends Kevin Gutzman and Brian McClanahan, who are constitutionalists, might come back with. They would say it's true that the Constitution has, you know, well, there were people who wanted to establish a nationalist government, you know, who wanted the federal government to have plenary power to do anything it wanted. And there were people who wanted it to have only enumerated powers. Now, what matters is not that some people, I mean, I hate the expression at the end of the day, but in other words,
yeah, me too.
Yeah, ultimately, what matters is not what the intentions of the worst people in the world were. What matters is, and in a way, it doesn't even matter the document itself. What matters are the terms on which the document was sold to the public. And at the ratifying conventions, over and over again, even the Federalists themselves clarified that the General Welfare Clause was not an open-ended grant of power. It wasn't a grant of power of any kind. The federal government would have only the powers expressly delegated to it. The phrase expressly delegated was used in at least a half dozen ratifying conventions. So even if, in other words, we can go back and look at bad aspects of the Constitution, what you look at with any legal document is the intentions, you know, is what people agreed to, basically. And people agreed to a limited government. That's what was sold to them at the ratifying convention. So if Sheldon Richmond finds that the Constitution has a lot of terrible features, don't we set that against, but at the ratifying conventions, the real document was sold to them as a limited government document. Even though the nationalists wanted it to be something other than it was, that's what it wound up being because that's how it was sold at the ratifying conventions.
Well, but how do we know that the people in the ratifying conventions weren't seeing the nationalists winking their eyes as they said that stuff? In other words, once you get into that game, I don't see how it's any guidance. But I can, and you'll forgive the expression, trump that. I can trump your argument with the following argument. Trump has now ruined the language, right? We can't say
right.
Trump's that anymore. I really regret that. I think we need to call him Drumpf, and that way we can restore the word Trump. But anyway, that's off the subject.
We've lost too many words already in this movement, haven't we?
Exactly. Besides, you don't like at the end of the day, I don't like going forward when that's the only
I
way
don't
you
either.
Know.
You know, maybe we need to do a whole show about, you know, grammatical and speech pet peeves or something.
I'm not using going forward except when I'm driving and when there's time travel into the past, then we can start saying going forward.
Right.
But anyway, here's a story that's in the book. When it came time to write the amendments that would become the Bill of Rights, and this was being propelled by Madison, lots of people promised to be, okay, yeah, we'll have a Bill of Rights, because people said, where's the Bill of Rights? There's no Bill of Rights. But once it was ratified and the first Congress met, everybody who promised a Bill of Rights said, "Ah, hell with that, we're in now, we don't need a Bill of Rights." Madison felt a bit honor bound, probably Jefferson was pushing him and he just felt honor bound. So he comes up with 12, he sifts through the 200 amendments or so that people at the conventions, the ratifying conventions, were proposing. He throws out all the ones that would change, in any way change the structure that was laid out in the Constitution, which is really what mattered to the Anti-Federalists. The Bill of Rights, while they made some noise about it, that wasn't the thing they cared about most. They wanted to change the structure, but he throws all those amendments out and sticks to the ones that were kind of the things that ended up in the Bill of Rights. He actually had 12; two got never got ratified. So what became number 10 is, of course, the famous one that seems to protect the states. Right? It says all powers. I don't want to have it exact here, but all powers not delegated to the United States are not prohibited, by the Constitution or reserved to the states and the people. So while that was being debated, a South Carolina representative by the name of Thomas Tudor Tucker, I love his name, stood up and said, I have an amendment. I want to insert the word expressly before delegated. So all powers not expressly delegated to the United States. Now, that had come out of the Articles of Confederation. Article 2 of the Articles of Confederation is a much very fortified version of this, what became number 10, or we could put it the other way. 10 is an extremely pale version of Article 2 of the Articles. People can look that up and see, or it's in my book. Anyway, Madison objects. I object to adding the word expressly. Why? Because all Constitution, and this is a quote now, must have powers by implication. Else, the Constitution would be an endless list of minutia. So, you'll notice, if you've gone through my book, there's a chapter called James Madison, Father of the Implied Powers Doctrine. Now, he might not have been the literal father. Someone else might have actually said that sooner, but he made quite a big deal of it, and he prevailed. They kept that word expressly out. So I think, in a way, that kind of tops your the argument you're relaying, that they were promised that they would, they only had the powers expressly delegated. And, you know, when the Constitution was first unveiled, James Wilson, a very prominent Pennsylvania judge who was a prime nationalist and was quite a big promoter of the Constitution, he gave a speech or wrote an article, I'm not sure which it was, where he talked about how it's plain as day, he says, roughly, that the Congress can only exercise the powers that are enumerated and everything else is left to the states. And Jefferson looked at that. Now, Jefferson was he was among the weakest of the Anti-Federalist types. And he was also in France a lot of the time. But he looked at it and said, I don't know what document James Wilson is reading, but I don't see that. And other people reacted the same way. Richard Henry Lee, other Anti-Federalists, said, what the heck is Wilson talking about when he says Congress or the federal national government could only exercise powers that are specifically, expressly enumerated and nothing else? They looked at that and laughed. They said, we're looking at two different documents. So it's not that clear. It's not clear at all. And they knew it. The people at the time knew it. Like I say, Madison and Hamilton understood this was going to be fought forever. It was never going to be settled. It was a compromise. They had to compromise.
Sheldon, just for the sake of showing the breadth of the book, say a word about the standing army, that issue. You have a chapter on that.
For some reason, I don't know where libertarians get this, but they think that the government was prohibited from having a standing army. Under the Constitution, people hated the standing army. Well, people did hate the standing army, but there's nothing in the Constitution that bars a standing army.
Okay.
It's certainly not prohibited, and there's every reason to think. It says Congress can raise an army. The only restriction is the budget has to be a 2-year budget. It can't be longer than 2 years. And I have a chapter on the standing army, and you can see what Hamilton and Madison said, why it was needed. And here's a general argument they made, first in regard to the army, but generally. They said, look, this new national government is going to face unlimited contingencies, unlimited situations. We can't predict what the situation's going to be. Therefore, the powers have to be equal to that. In other words, unlimited. They weren't arguing in the Federalist Papers, they weren't arguing that it was a limited government. I know at times, Madison says few and defined powers in one point. But if you look at it in connection with other things, they're saying, we have to give massive powers to this thing because we don't know what the future holds. Well, that's scary.
All right, we're coming up toward the end because I want people to check out what you've done. I don't want to give them the whole thing. We want to give them a flavor, right? So now I'm going to throw over to you. You've got 20 chapters in what is a book that people will be able to read quickly. I think they'll get a lot out of it. What do you feel like is something that really hits people between the eyes? That's just a shock, an argument they've not heard.
Well, here's an impression I would like to leave with readers. And I did try to make this book very accessible. The chapters are not long. It's not laden with footnotes, although you can find – I name the books where I get my my quotes and other things from, so I'm not totally leaving you in the woods. Well, no pun intended there. What I'm trying to do is show, in a way, the continuity of American history from this moment, 1787 to 1789, that period where they switched from the Articles to the Constitution, all the way to the current time. In other words, one of the I think the major mode of pushing the nationalists, the Federalists at the time, was what we today call national greatness. In other words, this will seem strange, but I think it's not crazy, that there is a continuity between the founders, the framers, the nationalists certainly among them, and neoconservatism. Now, I know that's going to sound insane, but if you look at what they did, they wanted a standing army, they wanted continental expansion, they wanted hemispheric expansion, they wanted Canada, they wanted Cuba. They were worried about Cuba long before the Russians and the communists. They were worried about the Russians in the Pacific Northwest. They were worried about the Indians and the Spanish, and they had national security on their mind. I have a chapter in there called Empire on Their Mind. They were empire builders from the start, and they were national greatness advocates. I'm convinced that if the state legislatures had been perfectly libertarian, in other words, if they hadn't engaged in debt relief, which they did, and I criticize that, if they hadn't done debt relief and other things libertarians would condemn, which Madison made a big deal of in moving for nationalization, even if none of that existed, the nationalists would have done what they did anyway. There's every reason to think that, because what they wanted was a big league nation. They wanted to compete in the big leagues. They thought we were the rising empire and we were going to replace the dying old empires of the old world. And you couldn't do that with a collection of states, with a mere confederation. And it moved a Jeffersonian in 1800, a guy by the name of Abraham Bishop, to say, and this is the epigram of the book, a nation which makes greatness its pole star can never be free. That's someone speaking in 1800. About what the Federalists had done in the first 11 years or so under the Constitution. And that was the great motive. That was the motive, national greatness. They wanted to be in the big leagues and beat back the old empires. That should sober us up about the Constitution. They needed the Constitution to accomplish that. They couldn't have done it under the Articles.
Well, this is a provocative book. It's a provocative conversation. It's called America's Counter-Revolution, The Constitution Revisited. Of course, I'll link to it at tomwoods.com/663, which is our clearinghouse page for this episode. But if people weren't to visit that page, where can they find the book? Amazon?
It's at Amazon. It's at both Kindle and in paperback. I have some material on the Constitution at my blog, Free Association, which is just sheldonrichman.com. And Richman is R-I-C-H-M-A-N. So sheldonrichman.com will find you some material on that. But yes, Amazon is where you can find it.
All right, so I'll also link to SheldonRichman.com. All right, well, good luck with it, Sheldon.
Thank you. We
got to see if we can get the articles from not that we're cheering for the articles either, but by comparison, obviously, we got to get them up from 1500 to somewhere. They've just been totally forgotten and dismissed. But anyway, great. I really enjoyed reading it, and I enjoyed talking to you. Thanks again.
Same here. Thank you very much.
All right, everybody. A couple things that you're going to enjoy hearing about. I'm so happy. Jordan Page, is a musician in the Liberty Movement. Ron Paul's had him at many, many events. He did a concert at my own house, and I just love the guy. And he had a family friend set up a GoFundMe campaign because his little boy needs surgery in Seattle, and there are a lot of transportation and travel-related expenses they were going to have to cover. So they put up a GoFundMe campaign, and I posted about it. I put it on Twitter and here and there mentioned it. And they weren't quite at their goal. And I thought, doggone it, this guy deserves to be at his goal. It's Jordan Page, for goodness sake. So I sent out a quick email to people on my list. If you're not on my list, by the way, it's an awesome email list to be on. And that sounds like it's an oxymoron, an awesome email list. But really, you're going to like getting my emails. You can go to tomwoods.com and click the red notify me button. You'll get my emails. So I sent out an email. I said, look, this is a good guy, and he really should be put over the top. And if you donate at least $50 to him, I'll give you a free subscription to Liberty Classroom. The basic plus big package for $119, give you that for nothing. And within half an hour, he had met his goal. So you guys are amazing. That was absolutely amazing. I had no idea it was going to go that fast. So thanks for doing that. The other thing is, all right, now here is a really great, you're going to thank me. You know, you're always thanking me, right? Here's another reason to thank me. PepperTreeSeasonings.com. All right. They're not an advertiser of the show, but the guy who runs it got the site up and running through my link. And so my deal is you start your site through my link, and I'll give you a shout out on the show, and I'll send you free two dozen free tutorials to help you get up and running on WordPress as a blogger. So PepperTreeSeasonings.com, they did send me their gourmet beef seasoning in the mail. And all I'll tell you is you would have to be an enemy of mankind not to enjoy this. Absolutely great. That's the sort of thing you can find at PepperTreeSeasonings.com. Also a couple of posts with recipes and techniques and stuff. Very worth checking out, and you know that if you're ordering, it's a gift that nobody's going to expect, and they're going to love you for, and you're helping out a Tom Woods Show listener. So PepperTreeSeasonings.com is the site. I will link to that also at TomWoods.com/663, and if you would like to get a shout-out and my free bonuses, then get all the details at TomWoods.com/publicity. All right, that's it for today, everybody. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.